This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents Helldivers 3, Deliverance, by Nicholas Sansbury Smith. This book is read by R.C. Bray. To my good friends and partners at Blackstone Publishing, thank you for helping me bring the Helldivers series to life. I'm honored to work with each and every one of you. A very great vision is needed, and the man who has it must follow it as the eagle seeks the deepest blue of the sky. Crazy Horse. 1. 6 years ago. Lightning forked through the center of a massive storm brewing above the Badlands. The bowl of cracked dirt seemed to continue forever in all directions. The constant stream of light illuminated a roadway that twisted through the barren terrain. Hundreds of years ago, fields of crops would have framed this road, but now there were only two living creatures here, leaving tracks in the dust. A man and his dog trekked over the broken asphalt. The man wore a black radiation suit with an olive scarf wrapped around the area where the crest of his chest armor met the bottom of his helmet. Long ago, the metal of his armor had shone, but years of exposure had faded everything to a dull gray. He walked with a slight limp in his gait, a product of injuries and bad joints. The man motioned for the dog to join him by his side as they plodded down the decaying road. While the 60-pound Siberian husky kept his crystal blue eyes on the path, the man kept his eyes on the swirling storm clouds. They were both searching, the dog for hostiles, the man for something he could hardly remember. Squinting, he studied the shape of a swollen cloud that reminded him of an oversized beetle. He halted on the road and lowered his rifle, tilting his head as memories flooded through his tormented mind.
"What you're looking for doesn't exist anymore," he said in a scratchy whisper. "They're all gone now."
The dog glanced up at him questioningly and then trotted ahead. The man remained standing in the gusting wind, scarf blowing like a pair of wings behind his helmet as he tried to recall his past. No matter how hard he tried, he simply couldn't remember certain things. Important things. Things such as who he had been in his old life, before he was left behind. But he could remember his name. It was scribbled on the first page of a dog-eared book he kept in a plastic sleeve inside the breast pocket of his vest.
"You are Xavier Rodriguez,"
he swallowed, forcing saliva down his dry throat.
"You are X," he said, louder this time. "You are the last man."
Miles looked back at him. The plastic of the dog's radiation suit whipped back and forth as he wagged his tail. X felt a tingle at the edges of his lips. It was the closest he had come to smiling in... how long? It took him a moment to realize he couldn't remember the last time.
"Keep moving," he said to himself.
The words became a mantra that he repeated in his mind as he navigated the shattered asphalt that had once been a highway. His path was the road. It connected the cities of the old world, where humanity had once thrived. In the distance, the skeletal husks of scrapers reached for the storm clouds. A child who had never seen a city wouldn't guess that the structures were made by humans. Someone who had never set foot down here would have thought they were part of the earth. And in some ways they were, just like the bones of the humans and animals that had once lived here. But X knew all too well what the ancient cities were, and what dwelled in the networks of interlacing streets. This city would be no different. It had once been home to millions of people. But now it was the lair of mutant beasts such as the Sirens, genetically engineered humans that had evolved into monsters. He no longer had a permanent home. His home was wherever he decided to stop and rest. Sleep came whenever his body needed it. With no one to talk to and nothing to do but trek across the blasted land, he had fallen into a routine that made him feel more machine than human. X walked. He didn't know how long he had been walking. He had lost track of time. In the wastes, time was everything, and time was nothing. He had learned this long ago, but how long, he couldn't say. In truth, he didn't want to know.
Like the grit whirling around him, memories of his old life surfaced and then blew away. Images and sounds were nearly impossible to recall. But something from his past kept him going. His destination was the place where water stretched across the horizon. The memory of that sight haunted him, called to him. He had forgotten the name humans used to call it, but he remembered from dives just how cold and dark it was. That seemed a lifetime ago. But so did his journey across the wastes. How long had he been traveling since he left Hades? 4 years, or was it 5? Could it be longer than that? Lightning lanced into the ground in the distance, searing the scarred earth. The boom of thunder rattled his visor. The wail that followed stopped him in mid-stride. Miles halted, ears perked inside his helmet. The screeching of the wind sounded just like them, a klaxon that signaled danger and death on swift wings. It was a sound X never forgot, a sound that always made him raise his battered carbine and point it at the irradiated landscape. He searched for the shadowy forms of the sirens, but saw nothing. Cold fingers of wind sneaked through the holes in his tattered boots and his clothing. Another draft blasted his side. The grit collected in layers beneath his suit and armor. No matter what he did, he couldn't seem to keep the dirt out. He threw the strap of his rifle over his back and pressed down on the loose duct tape flapping over his wrist. It had come undone and exposed his dark skin. He studied his flesh as if seeing it for the first time. The dirt caked his body like an extra layer of skin. He couldn't remember the last time his body was clean, but he had stopped caring. All that mattered was keeping out the radiation. X sucked in a long breath of filtered air, filling his lungs. Sometimes he forgot how exhausted he was from walking from city to city all this time, raiding old structures for anything he could use to survive as he searched for the ocean. That's what they called it, he thought. The ocean. He tightened a string over his wrist to hold the tape down, and then reached for his rifle. It caught on his rucksack. The massive ruck contained everything he owned, from the water purification kit that he pissed into each night to the blocks of calorie-rich synthetic food that gave him and the dog the energy to continue. The weight was a burden on his shoulders, but nothing like the weight of not knowing whether he was the last man on Earth. He pressed forward, forcing his legs to carry him a few more steps. Keep moving. His eyes flitted back to the storm clouds, disgorging bolts of electricity. The bright tendrils speared downward, licking the ground to the west. Another strike lashed the dirt to the east. In the interval between flashes, an oddly shaped light emerged across the dome of clouds, like a light bulb with a dying power source. This wasn't lightning. He studied the rays with a sense of awe. Where there should have been the blue residue of lightning, he saw a warm orange. It can't be, he mumbled. Miles tilted his helmet to look at this new anomalous sight. By the time X realized it was the sun, clouds had swallowed the warm glow. He hadn't seen the sun in a long time and had almost forgotten how beautiful it was. He exhaled, noticing he had been holding his breath. Seeing something from the past sometimes helped him remember other things. Closing his eyes, he tried to visualize the smooth, beetle-like contours of the airship he had once called home. Next, he pictured the interior. In his mind's eye, he saw the silhouettes of passengers walking through the narrow corridors. As in all the other times he tried to remember, these people had no faces. Pulling out his journal and a pen, he prepared to jot down anything he could recall. But the mental image was gone again already. A bolt of lightning slashed the earth in front of him, raising the hair on his neck, and rain began to pelt his body. He quickly replaced the precious book and pen back in their waterproof sleeve and stowed them in his vest. Then he raised the scope of his rifle to his visor and slowly raked the muzzle over the landscape, searching for shelter. There wasn't much out here besides the occasional trunk of a dead tree or the retaining wall of a building long since destroyed. But to the east he noticed patches of red poisonous weeds. Beyond the field of foliage that thrived in the radioactive conditions, A rocky hill shielded the brick foundations of an old community. It would have to do. X lowered the scope just as a flash of movement darted from one of those foundations and vanished into a hole in the ground. Lightning flashed above him, but he didn't so much as flinch. His gaze was locked onto a single spot. Out here, the movement could be anything from a dust storm to a mutant monster. Most of the beasts fed on plants, but they would happily feed on him and his dog if he got close enough. Thunder boomed above, another threat barreling down. He raised his left arm and checked the rad meter, which looked like an oversized clock. The radiation here was minimal. Then he scanned the sky again for any sign of the sirens. He hadn't seen any of the winged monsters in a long time. But he never let his guard down, always aware of the threat and listening for their otherworldly wails. "Come on, boy," X said. He left his night vision goggles off to conserve the battery and flicked on his flashlight instead, directing the bright beam at the dirt to the right of the road. Using the light to guide them, he fell into a run, with his only friend in the world by his side. Everywhere he looked, cracks and holes marred the earth like deformed flesh. X didn't like to stray from the road. It was safer to stick to the path. The road didn't move. It was the one thing on the cursed earth that seemed to remain constant. A beetle, half the size of Miles, poked a pair of ropey antennae out of a cavern in the dirt. X slowed and watched the black chitinous shell emerge. It skittered forward, antennae wobbling back and forth. Like many creatures on the surface, it had no eyes. Again he was reminded of the airship in the sky, but he was also reminded of all the things that lived underground, from the Badlands to the desert he had once crossed. Snakes, large enough to swallow a human, hunted in the dunes, their scaly armored flesh tunneling beneath the sand. His first meeting with them had nearly cost him his life. Usually the insects were harmless, but he didn't take any chances. Using his boot, he kicked the creature aside, sending it scuttling for cover. He continued, eyes flitting over the cracks and holes in the ground. He was more concerned with falling in a crevice and breaking an ankle than with anything that might crawl out of the ground. That would be bad. And sometimes the holes harbored bigger things than insects. That would be worse. The ground was solid here, at least. Trekking across sand was something he never wanted to do again. "Stay close, boy," he said to Miles. The rocky hill grew larger as they approached. It was a natural bluff, not a mound of scree or debris from a destroyed building. Even better, there was an overhang that would shield him from the wind and rain. He jogged faster, anxious to set out his tracking gear and start a fire. Lightning sizzled across the sky to the west, and the rumble of thunder followed an instant later. The field of poisonous plants retreated in the sudden downpour of rain, curling into holes in the ground. Drops of rain hit his visor, sluicing down the thick glass. X shut off his flashlight and chinned his night vision goggles back on as he approached the hill. Miles halted too, but not for lack of light. Unlike the man, the dog had genetic modifications that allowed him to see in almost complete darkness. "What is it?" X asked, bringing up his rifle. They stood in silence for a few moments, sheets of toxic rain beating their radiation suits. The dog finally trotted onward, and the man lowered his rifle, following cautiously. Brick foundations traced the ground 200 feet ahead. The bluff rose 3 or 4 stories into the sky. He used the side of his boot to scrape mud off an old street that carved through the terrain. Streets were good. Not as good as the road, but they didn't play tricks on the eye the way the dirt did. Metal poles protruded out of the dirt at odd angles, like arrows carelessly dropped along the street. Hundreds of years ago, they had provided power to this small community, but the wires were long gone. X navigated the wet, ruined settlement, wondering whether this place had survived the initial bombs that destroyed most of the old world. He stopped and bent down to look at something else sticking out of the soil. He brushed the dirt off the skeletal remains of a human hand. Plucking a ring off one of the fingers, he examined it with his flashlight before slipping it into his pocket for later. Then he covered the shallow grave with fresh dirt, which was quickly turning to mud. Standing, He scanned the area once more, looking for the hole where he had seen something dart away. That creature was bigger than a beetle, and he didn't like surprises. It took him only a few seconds to identify the sinkhole. He motioned for Miles and then trained his rifle on the entrance as he approached, listening for the electronic noises of the sirens, but hearing nothing besides the boom of thunder. At 100 feet, he stopped and brought up his hand. The dog sat on his haunches, waiting for orders. Reaching into his back pocket, X brought out an old can full of coins he had collected on his journey across the wastes. He dropped the ring inside and secured the lid. After making sure the thin cord was attached tightly to the top, he tossed the can. It vanished in the hole, clanking as it fell. The cord caught in his hand, and he began pulling it back toward the surface. Another sound replied to the echoing metal. It started as a squawk, but rose to a high-pitched squeaking. X pulled the cord until the can emerged. It clattered over the dirt as he yanked it a few more feet. Then he raised the rifle and aimed it at the lip of the hole, waiting for his bait to draw whatever lurked there out into the open. He could hear the creature's claws scraping rock on its way to the surface. This was no beetle. Miles's tail dropped between his legs, but X remained steady, keeping the rifle barrel trained on the opening. A deformed head with a spiky flesh mohawk popped out of the opening, focusing a pair of bulging, bloodshot eyes on the can. It sniffed the air with a nose that was little more than holes in the middle of its face. Then it glared at X, undeterred by the rain striking its crazed eyeballs, or apparently by the sight of a man. The beast heaved itself from the hole with two long arms covered in hardened scales like a sort of organic armor. The raised plates ran the length of its body, covering broad shoulders, a wiry torso, and powerful back legs. X had never seen one of these before. Not wanting to waste precious bullets, he studied the beast for weak spots. It stood on all fours, its arched back lined with ridges and several fins. At its throat, a collar of thicker armor opened and closed like a vent as the beast breathed. Miles growled a warning, and X aimed at the gill-like feature. The creature tilted its head toward him just as he pulled the trigger. The round lanced into the soft flesh in the opening of the collar, blowing out gore that painted the rain-soaked ground. The blood looked green, but then so did everything else in the view of his NVGs. Unable to cry out, the creature flopped silently on the ground as it choked on its own blood. X lowered the rifle and pulled his knife. By the time he reached the body, the abomination was dead. He looked toward his dog.
"You think it tastes good?"
Miles trotted over, sniffed the body through the breathing filter around his muzzle, and walked away, uninterested.
"Yeah, me neither," X said.
He pushed the carcass back into the hole and pointed the rifle barrel into the green-hued darkness. The lizard-like monster hit the bottom a few seconds later, the thump and crunch echoing up from the hole. The sound faded away, leaving the man and the dog once again alone in the downpour. X lowered his gun and walked over to the shelter of the bluff, where he took off his rucksack and rested it on the ground. He checked his rad meter again, and seeing that the area was still a green zone, he took off his helmet. Then he bent down and removed Miles's helmet for him. Next, he pulled out 3-foot-long stakes attached to the side of his backpack and handed one of them to the dog. Miles gripped the stake in his mouth and trotted off into the pouring rain. X followed with the other 2 stakes. Working together, they stuck the poles into the dirt at 3 different locations, forming a triangle around their camp. When they finished, X raised his wrist computer and activated the network. If anything tried to sneak into the area, a warning alarm would sound on his HUD, beeping in his helmet. He checked the data on his wrist monitor, and seeing that everything looked good, he returned to his pack and pulled out his metal pot. Next, he put his mini-stove on the ground and ignited the flame powered by a long-lasting fuel cell. X walked out from beneath the overhang and put the pot on the ground, then shook open the telescoping catchment funnel and set it over the pot. Rain began to trickle down the broad, conical structure, and in minutes, the pot was full. He brought it back to the stove and set it on the burner. Then he dropped in a pill that would purify the water of radiation and kill any toxins that weren't boiled away. He was running low on the precious pills, but he and Miles had to eat. Finally, he pulled out a block of synthetic food from his pack. Using his knife, he lopped off a chunk of the bar and dropped it into the water. The brown block expanded into something that looked like a nest of snakes. A few minutes later, they had a pot of noodles and broth. X sat his aching bones down on a smooth boulder. He waited for the contents of the pot to cool, then reached inside with his gloved fingers. He pulled out a strand and handed it to Miles, who wolfed it down without bothering to chew. With the dog's blue eyes locked on his, X raised another noodle to his lips and sucked it down. A memory flashed through his mind. He was in his old quarters on the airship he had once called home, sharing a meal with a boy wearing a tinfoil hat. The son of his best friend. Aaron, he remembered. Aaron Everhart and his son, Michael Everhart. In the memory, X had watched Michael, who went by Tin, slurping down a plate of food. But as with most of the memories, the boy's features were blurry, like a broken video screen. X pulled out his journal and jotted down the memory anyway. It quickly faded in his mind like all the others, but this time he was able to capture it on the page. A new memory emerged as he finished writing the first one down. It was the moment Tin had handed him a piece of paper just before that last dive stranded X on the surface. "Face your future." X winced, the scars on his body stretched over his tired muscles. "Without fear," he said with an exhale, finishing the quote as he wrote it into his journal. Times like this, when he could remember what someone had said or the words scrawled on a piece of paper, were rare. So rare that he couldn't recall the last time he'd had such a vivid memory. Lightning webbed across the sky in the distance, and a third memory surfaced. This one he had no trouble recalling, for it haunted him often as he tried to fall asleep in this blasted wasteland. He felt himself falling through the clouds, a siren's leathery wings wrapped around him. He saw blue battery units, the beating heart of a helldiver. Three featureless faces looking down at him, fellow divers, one of them the woman he once loved, as they ascended toward the hive, and he fell back toward hell. It wasn't a memory he wanted to put in his journal. X growled as the memories faded away like the afterimage of the lightning. He put his book back into its sleeve and finished his dinner. Then he rolled out the blanket attached to the bottom of his backpack, and Miles curled up beside him. "Good night, boy," X said. He reached for his helmet and brought it over by the blanket, catching a glimpse of his reflection in the mirrored visor. The flickering fire illuminated a haggard face he almost didn't recognize. A stranger. A ghost. X brought his gloved fingers up to the thick, graying beard over a square jawline. With his finger, he traced over a scar forming a ravine up his right cheek and through his eyebrow. Dark eyes, framed by crow's feet, stared back at him, the irises almost lost to the fathomless black pupils. He set the helmet down, unable to look at himself anymore. Bones aching, he grunted as he rested his head on the blanket. The glow of the fire filled the cracks in the stone overhang. Rain pattered down outside their shelter. The sound was calming, and he didn't fight the wave of fatigue sweeping over him. Minutes later, he was asleep, dreaming of events and people from his past. But not even in his dreams could he remember faces or voices. The dreams, like reality, were mostly just fragments. A beeping sound entered his dream. His eyes sprang open to darkness as the chirp of the alarm snapped him awake. He saw a silhouette to his left. Miles stood growling and staring out beyond the perimeter. X fumbled for his helmet, cursing his stupidity. He had forgotten to put it back on before drifting off to sleep. As soon as he slipped it over his head, he saw several contacts on the mini-map in the upper right corner. They were what had set off the alarm. Cursing, he grabbed his rifle and angled it out toward the abandoned settlement, scanning for targets. His eyes flitted from the map on his HUD to the green hue of the terrain, but nothing moved in the sheets of rain. "What the hell?" Miles growled behind X, but the dog wasn't looking at the settlement. He was glaring, teeth bared, at the wall behind them.
X slowly raised his rifle at the Tower of Stone, half expecting a siren or some other beast to come skittering down the side.
"What is it, boy?" he whispered.
He checked his HUD again. The contacts were coming from his right. Miles continued growling at the rock, and X moved slowly, rifle-shouldered, over to examine the sloped wall. A crunching sounded, and a cascade of rocks crumbled down the side. He gasped as a pair of massive eyeballs blinked from inside what appeared to be a solid wall. A limb the size of a man reached directly out of the rock. Then a chest emerged, followed by the rest of the body. Swallowing hard, X scrambled backward as the beast peeled away from the wall and dropped down. The impact of the 7-foot-tall monstrosity shook the ground as dust puffed around its hooves.
"Run!" X shouted.
Miles turned and ran as the beast staggered toward X. He raised his rifle and aimed at the creature's chest. 3 rounds smashed through the rock-like armor covering flesh and vital organs. The rock monster let out a deep howl and swiped with a long arm. Its massive paw hit the muzzle of the gun and knocked it free. X staggered backward and reached to pull his blaster from the holster on his thigh like a gunslinger preparing for a showdown. He pointed the gun at the beast's forehead and pulled the trigger. Click. His heart thumped against his ribs. Contacts beeped on his HUD. More of the monsters were out there, awakening from their hibernation. The creature in front of X took another step forward and raised its thick, muscular arms. The flesh looked exactly like weathered stone. X continued to retreat from the camp. He flipped open the brake of his blaster but then decided just to run. The beast followed, opening its wide maw and releasing a roar that boomed like thunder. The rocky ledge shook as 4 more of the beasts dropped to the ground. Miles barked at them and then looked to X for orders. He eyed the rifle, then the rucksack still tucked against the wall. They would have to come back later for the gear.
"Go, Miles!" X shouted.
He motioned for the dog to follow him into the toxic rain. They could fight another day. 2. Present day. The launch bay reeked of sweat and fear. Captain Leon Jordan hated that smell. It was the bouquet of the hive, a scent he had breathed his entire life. Normally, technicians, engineers, and helldivers preparing for a descent to the poisoned surface would have crowded the bay. But today there were no flashing lights or countdowns warning of an imminent launch. That didn't mean the space was empty, though. Far from it. For the first time in the documented history of the hive, there weren't enough helldivers to make a jump. Only 3 remained. 2 of them were in the sick bay, one with a broken back from a mission years ago, and the other with cancer. The 3rd diver, Jordan's former lover Katrina, sat in the brig. Instead of the pre-dive bustle, hundreds of citizens had squeezed into the launch bay to mourn the loss of the men and women who hadn't returned from the last dive. They all stared across the room at the smooth plastic domes like giant eggs covering the launch tubes. Only a few knew that the divers hadn't all perished at the hilltop bastion, and that Jordan had chosen to leave them behind. The divers might very well have still been alive when he gave the order to leave them down there. But the traitors had made their choice, and paid the price. Today we gather to honor the divers who gave their lives on the last dive to the hilltop bastion, Jordan said, his voice booming through the vaulted room. Every face turned in his direction as he stepped out from the crowd and walked toward the launch tubes. Stopping at the 1st plastic dome, he turned and scrutinized those gathered. At the front of the crowd, Lieutenant Hunt, Jordan's new XO, and Ensign Ryan both stood stiffly. They knew the truth about what had happened at the hilltop bastion. But as loyal soldiers, they would protect the truth with their lies or face the consequences. There were several others who knew what had happened, men such as Ty Parker, who were not so trustworthy as Ryan and Hunt. The technician was now cooling his heels several cells down from Katrina. Jordan still wasn't sure just what Chief Engineer Sampson knew, but the man had remained loyal so far, and he was far too valuable to throw into the brig, or jettison out of an airlock. Jordan continued his scan of the crowd. Right of Lieutenant Hunt stood Sergeant Leonard Jenkins, commander of the militia. He also knew the truth. In fact, he knew more than any of Jordan's crew, especially about the false prophet, Janga. And while he had been loyal thus far, Jordan was starting to suspect that Jenkins didn't like the way he was running the ship. It was in the subtle things, the vaguely insolent slouch in his stance, the second of hesitation before following an order. He would need to do something about Jenkins, but first he had to get everyone else in line. After letting out a rueful sigh that could be heard throughout the room, Jordan began the speech he had been planning for several days. "Commander Michael Tin Everhart, Commander Rick Weaver, Magnolia Khatib, Roger Dodger Mintel, Layla Brower, and Andrew Pipe Bolden might not have returned with fuel cells or supplies for the hive, nor did they find a habitable place for us to set down, but their sacrifice was not without worth. Their loss, though regrettable in the utmost, proves a point that many of us have had a difficult time accepting." He waited a few seconds before continuing. "They proved there is nothing down there awaiting humanity besides death, no miraculous green zone, no radiation-free area where we can sow new crops, nothing but death." He paused again to let the words sink in. Among the crowd were several lower deckers, as evidenced by their poor hygiene and tattered clothing. A few of them shed tears. Others held their heads high, choosing to honor the memory of the divers without showing any emotion. Jordan respected them for that. He had never trusted anyone who was overly emotional. People like Captain Ash, who put her heart before her brain. Doing so compromised a person, making it impossible to be rational. One thing was certain. He had the unwavering attention of everyone in the room. Good. He was sick of the traitors, thieves, and snakes. The only way humanity would continue to survive on the hive was through complete obedience. He would tolerate nothing less. The time for niceties was over. "If anyone in this launch bay still believes there is something down there for us, feel free to step forward. I will happily instruct our technicians to give you a one-way ticket to the surface so that you may investigate further." Jordan gestured toward the launch tubes.
"Does this mean we're giving up the search entirely?" asked a deep voice.
Jordan searched the crowd to find the man who had interrupted him, but he saw no one obvious.
"Step forward if you wish to speak," he commanded.
The sea of passengers parted down the middle to disgorge a haggard-looking Cole Mintel.
"Are you saying my son gave his life just to prove a point?" he asked.
Jordan considered his response for a moment. The last thing he wanted was to make a scene with the disgruntled father of a dead helldiver. Besides, Roger had played his part perfectly, using the Industrial Tech Corporation card Jordan had given him to reveal what was really down there.
"Your son died for far more than that, sir," Jordan said, opting for the truth. "Your son died by discovering what awaits anyone who sets foot on the surface."
Cole folded his muscular forearms, honed by countless hours of woodworking, across his chest. Confused faces centered on Jordan. He still had their attention. He was in control of the crowd, but to keep it, he would have to tell more of the truth than he had planned on. The truth about the world they feared, and the idea of a home that some still believed possible.
"Roger and the other helldivers entered the hilltop bastion because of bogus information from Captain Ash," Jordan said. "Their deaths are on her shoulders, not mine. She had hoped that the hilltop bastion might be an area we could turn into a new home, but as I suspected, the bunker was nothing more than a tomb overrun by creatures out of a nightmare."
Cole remained standing in front of the crowd with his dark eyes locked on Jordan. It was going to take more than this cryptic explanation to convince the father that his son had died for a noble cause. Running his hand over the smooth plastic surface of a launch tube, Jordan said,
"Captain Ash was right in a way. The hilltop bastion was a good place for humans to wait for the radiation to clear on the surface.
but then the sirens and other mutated beasts claimed it as their own home. Thanks to the information your son and his fellow divers retrieved, we can now focus on avoiding places like this and surviving in the skies.
If you knew there were these sirens down there, why did you send my boy?
Cole growled, lowering his arms and clenching his fists.
You misunderstand, Jordan said. I didn't know for sure.
His eyes flitted to Sergeant Jenkins, who glared at Cole, ready to silence the man at a moment's notice. Jordan didn't want it to come to that. He wouldn't let anything disturb the fragile peace aboard the ship. The loss of so many divers at once had united the upper and lower decks for the first time in as long as he could remember.
I'm truly sorry for the loss of your son, Jordan said. But Roger's death has reaffirmed what most of us already believed. Life will continue in the sky for the next 250 years until the radiation and electrical storms have finally abated.
He patted the launch tube one last time. Once, it had dropped the very bombs that destroyed the surface. Now it dropped the men and women who kept the ship in the air. After a half minute of silence, Jordan forced a smile.
I was going to keep this confidential, but your son sent a final message to the Hive.
Cole squinted at him, as if looking for the lie.
What did my son say? He wanted his discovery of the monsters at the Hilltop Bastion to embolden us. He said he wanted more men and women to follow his lead and fight tooth and nail for the future of humanity.
Jordan waited a beat and then added, Roger knew that his death and the deaths of the other divers would leave a void, but in his final moments he sent a message of courage and a challenge to those of us still breathing. Jordan saw the bob of Cole's Adam's apple as he swallowed. His bald fists fell limply to his sides, and he slipped his calloused hands into his pockets. Jordan almost smiled. He had turned the tide with yet another beautiful lie. He pressed his advantage.
Today we're gathered not only to mourn the lost Helldivers, but to honor them as well. And in keeping with Roger Mintel's final request, I humbly ask for volunteers. Who of you will accept his challenge? Who will step forward and become a Helldiver?
If the airship had a nerve center, Michael Everhart was sitting directly in the middle of it. The smooth, charcoal-gray bulkheads rumbled quietly throughout the bridge of the ITC airship Deliverance. Monitors and touchscreens flashed data all around him. The bridge was a third the size of the Hive's, and instead of split levels, it consisted of a singular circular space, with all stations positioned around a central island that served as a desk. Bulkhead-mounted monitors surrounded the space, and a single leather chair sat facing the largest screen at the helm, with a row of chairs behind the captains. The one thing Michael missed from his old home was the ship's oak wheel. Here there were modern flight controls for the captain and supporting pilots. The differences in subtle details reminded Michael that this wasn't home, and never would be. Deliverance was simply a vehicle that he would use to find Xavier Rodriguez before returning to the Hive. He couldn't quite believe that X was still alive down there. But he also had trouble believing they had escaped the Hilltop Bastion in a brand new ship. Well, most of them had escaped. Not everyone had been so lucky. Commander Weaver and Pipe had lost their lives. And for what? To be used as pawns in Captain Jordan's private agenda? Their blood was on Jordan's hands, and Michael was going to make sure the son of a bitch paid for their deaths. But first, he needed to figure out how they were going to survive. He focused on the screens, taking in as much information as possible, but his expertise was with the systems of the Hive. Deliverance was much more sophisticated, a newer model than the ancient airship he had grown up on. And after a few hours of cleaning dust off the bridge, she shone as she must have coming off the assembly line 2 centuries ago. He tapped the holographic screen in front of him and pulled up the flight data. Unlike the Hive, Deliverance relied heavily on turbofans and thrusters. It also had a single nuclear engine and no helium gas bladders at all, which explained the smaller size.
Deliverance also came equipped with the first artificial intelligence that Michael had ever met. Timothy Pepper, manager of the Hilltop Bastion, had transferred his consciousness to the sentient program upon his death. That program was now running the airship. According to Timothy, this was Deliverance's maiden journey. That didn't inspire confidence. Michael, Layla, Magnolia, and Roger had spent the past 2 days working on a host of problems ranging from mechanical to electrical issues. Every time they fixed something, another alarm would beep, indicating a new crisis. Currently, they were all off working in different compartments.
"Timothy, can you give me a sit-rep on our operating systems?" Michael asked.
"One moment, Commander Everhart," Timothy replied over the PA system.
Michael continued scanning the data while he waited, unable to relax his tired muscles in the firm leather seat. For the first time in his life, he was actually sitting in something new.
"The nuclear engine is operating at 85%, and the energy grid is at 75%, Timothy said. "But several secondary systems are not functioning properly. Life support systems are currently at 51% and dropping. Only 3 of 6 thrusters are working, and the turbofans are..."
The oval hatches to the bridge whisked open, and footsteps clattered across the metal platform, stopping Timothy in mid-sentence. Michael twisted in his seat to see who it was. Layla, his lover and best friend, stood silhouetted in front of the open hatch. By her posture, he could tell something else was wrong.
"There you are," she said.
The overhead lights flicked on, spreading a blanket of bright white over the room. Layla's freckled face was covered in grease, and her braided blonde hair was draped over one shoulder. Pulling her hands from the pockets of the baggy blue sweatshirt that hid her athletic body, she caught his gaze. He hurried over to meet her.
"Hi," he said. "What's up?"
She smiled warmly.
"Are you okay?"
"Yeah." He raised one brow.
"You?"
Her deep brown eyes flitted to the metal platform as some thought or memory passed through her mind, casting a cloud over her normally sunny features. She met his gaze again and sighed.
"I'm hanging in there."
Before he could reply, she wrapped her arms around him in a tight embrace.
"I guess I just missed you."
"I've missed you too," he whispered back.
Since leaving the Hilltop Bastion, neither of them had found much time to talk. When they weren't working, they were sleeping, too exhausted to make love during the scant time they had alone together.
"Timothy was just giving me a report on the secondary systems," Michael said. "It's not good."
They pulled apart as the AI's translucent form solidified over the platform beside them. The computer-generated version of Timothy mimicked the real man, from the old-fashioned suit to the neatly trimmed hair and beard.
"Would you like me to continue that report, sir?" the AI asked.
"Not right now. How far are we from Commander Rodriguez's coordinates, and how long will it take us to get there?"
"I require additional parameters. At what speed do you intend to fly?"
Michael rubbed the bridge of his nose. Timothy looked and sounded like a person, but he was still a machine.
"Obviously, I want to get there as fast as possible," he said, frustration bleeding into his voice.
"Until the secondary systems are functioning properly, and at least one more thruster is working, I do not recommend flying at full speed," Timothy said.
"At our current trajectory, then, how long until we get to X?"
"It depends on weather conditions, Commander. The ship's meteorological systems are not functioning at optimal levels either, which..."
"Just give me a number," Michael said.
62 hours, 15 minutes, and 32 seconds, Timothy replied.
Layla reached out and put a hand on his back to rub his aching muscles.
"We have time," she said. "X has survived this long. A few days extra isn't going to matter."
"But what if it does?" Michael asked, pulling away.
He wasn't trying to sound rude, but she simply didn't understand.
"We left him down there 10 years ago. Can you imagine what that's been like for him? He's been all by himself the whole time."
Michael had thought of little else since learning that X was still alive. Days of wondering what he would be like now, or whether he would be able to forgive them.
"We have to get to him as quickly as possible, Timothy," Michael said. "To hell with optimum efficiencies. Full speed ahead."
"Understood, Commander."
Layla reached for Michael's hand.
Listen, I get how you feel.
Do you? She dropped his hand and shook her head.
I'm trying to help, but you're not doing a very good job of letting me.
I'm doing my best to keep this mission going, Layla. She looked back at him, her eyes filled with equal parts frustration and love.
I know. With Weaver gone, you're in charge. You hold rank. That means Mags, Roger, and I are counting on you to make the right decisions for all of us.
Meaning what, exactly? She sighed.
Meaning that tearing the ship apart just to reach X a few hours earlier is selfish. I'm sorry, but it's true.
Michael drew in a quick breath, intending to defend his position, but suddenly the passionate fire that heated his veins only moments before eased, cooled by her soft touch. She was right. He entwined his fingers with hers.
Sorry. I won't put our lives in jeopardy. I need to be patient. It's just...
You blame yourself for X.
Yeah.
She kissed him, a light brush of her lips across his.
Michael, X being left behind is not your fault. It's Jordan's, and he will pay. Come on. Let's go find the others and get something to eat.
Timothy, belay my previous orders, Michael said. Keep us at a safe speed.
Copy that, sir. Michael followed Layla out of the bridge, his thoughts troubled. They were getting so close to the man who had been a second father to him, the man everyone had given up for dead. A few days ago, X had been nothing but a ghost. But in just over 60 hours, Michael could be reunited with the most legendary helldiver ever. What would they say to each other after all this time? Would X even recognize the man Michael had become, and more troublingly, would Michael recognize X after his long ordeal on the surface? The oval hatch whispered shut behind them. Lights along the floor illuminated the black metal bulkheads. Absent were the bright paintings and graffiti that covered the hive. Michael was already missing the scenes that he used to look at every morning on his way to work. It was odd to walk through a passage that hardly anyone had ever used before.
"This place gives me the creeps," he said.
"Don't be a ninny, Tin," Layla said, chuckling.
"Really? You're still calling me that?
Tin or ninny?"
A warning sensor cut the teasing short.
"What's that?" Michael asked.
Timothy's smooth voice replied a moment later.
"A minor fluctuation in the electrical grid. It is now at 70%.
They continued walking down the corridor. It was going to take a long time to search each of the quarters for supplies, but for now his focus was on getting the ship working properly. They passed the hatches of officers' quarters, then the berthing areas for the rest of the crew.
"This place is freaking massive," Layla said. "But it doesn't look like it was designed to hold as large a population as the hive. There aren't enough cabins."
Michael pulled his shoulder-length hair back and looped a tie around it as he moved.
"Seems that way."
"I guess it looks a lot bigger with just us four."
Timothy cleared his holographic throat.
"Us five aboard," Layla corrected herself.
"Thank you," replied Timothy's voice over the PA system.
Layla smiled.
"Glad to hear you have a sense of humor,"
she whispered over to Michael.
"Still don't trust him, though."
If Timothy heard her, he didn't reply. Michael slowed when they reached the largest hatch on the ship. A sign that read, "Weapons Compartment," crested the bulkhead. After losing most of their weapons and ammunition back at the Hilltop Bastion, this was the top room on his list of places to investigate. Michael tried to spin the wheel handle, but it wouldn't budge.
"Won't open?" Layla asked.
He shook his head and looked up at the closest of the black balls that served as Timothy's eyes.
"Can you unlock this for me?"
"One moment," Timothy replied. A second later, he reported,
"I am sorry, Commander, but the hatch is protected by an encrypted password."
Michael scratched the stubble on his chin and looked at Layla. She shrugged again.
"Can't you override it?" Michael asked. "I do not have the appropriate permission," Timothy said. "These quarters were locked by General Stan Lorne on March 15, 2075. Overriding the system could trigger a self-destruct mechanism."
"What the hell is he talking about?" Layla asked.
The ship will blow up if we try to open that door?
We'll figure it out later. For now, let's leave it.
Michael pointed with his head, and they continued to the engine room hatch. Layla spun the wheel handle, and Michael helped her swing open the hatch. A dimly lit spiral staircase extended several floors down. Hot air blasted his face as he followed Layla into the bowels of the ship. Halfway down, he wiped the beads of sweat off his forehead. The temperature continued to rise the deeper they descended. Near the bottom, he heard voices. Loud voices. An argument from the sounds of it.
"I told you we don't have enough," Magnolia shouted.
"We do have enough, but barely," Roger replied. "You need to trust me."
Layla stopped at the open hatch below Michael and flung a glance up at him. He motioned for her to keep walking and followed her out into the engine compartment. Catwalks stretched across the second level overlooking the generators and engines.
"So you're going to be the one to tell Commander Everhart?" Magnolia asked. "Because I sure as hell don't want to break the news."
Magnolia and Roger were standing near a wall of lockers, and she held what appeared to be a parachute. The hum of machinery filled the lull in their conversation.
"What's going on here?" Michael asked.
Magnolia whirled to face him. She brushed a strand of blue hair over her ear and snorted, pointing at Roger. He wiped his forehead, then looked in Michael's direction. The tape holding the rims of his glasses together had come undone, and one of the frames sagged over his eye. He pushed it back up, then used his sleeve to wipe the grease off his forehead. When he didn't reply, Magnolia spoke for him.
"We only have enough material to make two parachutes, but Roger thinks we can extend it to three, maybe even four, which I say is dangerous as hell."
Confused, Michael looked back to Layla.
"Why do we need parachutes?" he asked.
She sank her hands in the pockets of her baggy sweatshirt and looked away. Michael turned back to Roger, knowing he would get a straight answer out of the man. Roger couldn't lie to save his life.
"Tell me why we need parachutes," Michael asked again.
Timothy's hologram suddenly flickered in the space between Michael and Roger. Everyone looked at the AI.
"Commander Everhart, I do apologize for not telling you earlier, but it is not safe to land Deliverance at the coordinates Mr. Xavier transmitted due to a massive electrical storm."
"And you didn't tell me this because," Michael said.
"I would have earlier, but you cut me off."
"I thought you said the weather sensors aren't working properly."
There was a pause.
"Is that a question?"
"Yes."
"Then that is correct, Commander," Timothy said. "The meteorological sensors are not working properly, but radar has picked up a storm covering 100 square miles over the source of the last distress signal. In order to reach Mr. Xavier's location, you will need to dive through the storm or proceed on foot for approximately 50 miles over radioactive territory."
3. 4 years earlier. Xavier Rodriguez watched the storm from the safety of an ancient vehicle stranded at the edge of a cliff. Thunder rumbled, a constant din that shook the metal bulkheads around him. For hundreds of years, the armored truck had sat on the crest of a hill once covered in thick forest. The former occupants, a pair of soldiers, were now buried beside the deflated tires. X had decided to honor the old way of putting humans to rest by digging holes in the earth and covering them with dirt. He was safely back inside the rusty armored truck now, sitting behind the steering wheel in a cracked leather seat with Miles curled up next to him. The interior was surprisingly well-preserved, considering its age. It had also provided one of the best finds ever. Maps showing military bunkers across the United States. These weren't ITC facilities, and he hoped they would have power cells, food, weapons, and perhaps even other people. Leaning forward, he examined the lettering on the bulkhead. It was some sort of model number. What little he knew about the old world was from experiences like this. The vehicle was called a Striker and had served as a mobile command center for troops during war. While the electrical and mechanical systems had stopped working long ago, one of the scopes still functioned, and he was confident he could get the radio back online. Through the thick glass window, he watched the bowl of the storm swirling over the flattened city. Yellow light churned deep inside the guts of the clouds. A scratching noise made him jump, and Miles looked up as a spider with purple legs skittered over the glass. It pecked at the bulletproof glass with its beak-like jaws, and then looked at X with a dozen bulbous eyes.
"It's okay, boy," X said. "Just a bug."
The creature pecked at the window again, then moved to the upper right corner where it attached itself to the glass with limbs tipped by suction cups.
"Looks like we have a new friend," X whispered.
He didn't mind, as long as it stayed outside. Suddenly, a vision of a bite wound filled his mind. Venom from the wound melted the man's skin, slowly consuming the entire leg. The scene was from 20 years ago, when X had been forced to watch a fellow diver succumb to a bite from a spider like the one outside. The mutated arachnid could kill a grown man in seconds with a single bite. The storm belched webs of electricity over the city below, lashing the decaying structures over and over. From this vantage point, X could see a huge crater on the other side of the city. The bomb had leveled almost everything, leaving behind nothing but twisted metal and concrete foundations. The hill the vehicle sat on was burned bald, with not even a tree stump left behind. Rocks and boulders peppered the steep slope, their surfaces glazed and sooted even now, centuries after the nuclear explosion. It was only a guess, but perhaps these soldiers had driven to the top of the hill to assess the damage after the blast. For some reason, they never left the vehicle again, dying inside the mobile command center. Perhaps it had been from radiation poisoning, or some other illness. The bodies had been too badly decomposed to tell.
At least the monsters didn't get them.
In the strobe flash from several lightning strikes, a flitter of motion caught his eye. He followed the movement to a sinkhole in one of the streets. The silhouetted form slithered into the opening and vanished. The openings in the street led to vast sewer and rail systems under the city, and he avoided them at all costs. A human and his dog had no place setting foot down there. Still, he would need to find a way across the debris field sooner or later. They couldn't wait here much longer. He was low on food again, and down to 2 blaster shells and 1 magazine for his rifle. Miles looked up, sniffed the air, and reoriented his furry body. They had been hiding inside the vehicle for several days, maybe more. X had lost track of time again. The sporadic boom of thunder continued. It was calming in a way. X wished he could stay sheltered here longer, but he still had hundreds of miles to go before he reached the coast. He looked at the spider once more and then flipped the hatch down over the inside of the window. Darkness filled the interior. He lit an emergency candle and placed it on the dash before climbing into the command center behind the front seat, where he lit a second candle. The flames cast a warm glow over the monitors and radio equipment. Several bucket seats faced the equipment, all of them covered in fine dust. Miles followed X into the compartment and sat at his feet while he reached into his vest and pulled out the book. In the dim light, he scanned its contents. A picture fell out. He held up the image of palm trees swaying in the wind on a beach. Teal water slapped the edge. This was where he was headed, although he knew it wouldn't look the same. 2 years earlier, as X was starting to lose his mind, he had found the image during a raid of an abandoned bunker. He had also found the book then. The pages had been empty, but now they were filled with his words and other things he had collected over the years. The book helped him remember those he had lost. Rhonda, his wife, and Aaron Everhart, his best friend. It also contained descriptions of the people he was still searching for. Michael Everhart, Magnolia Khatib, and Katrina DeVita. He had described them to the best of his memory so he might never forget. There were also pages dedicated to the people he had some serious questions for, people such as Captain Maria Ash and Lieutenant Leon Jordan, the people who had left him behind. After recording a note to himself about the spider's venom, he set the book on the bench next to the candle and reached into his pack. He took out a power pack and set it by the radio, then connected them with the attached cord. He then used a second cord to patch his wrist monitor into the power pack. Miles watched curiously as X jabbed at the cracked touchscreen of his wrist computer. As the radio equipment charged, he tapped into the system that would allow him to transmit on any open channels.
"Maybe Captain Ash will hear this one," he mumbled.